Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. I'm Mike, your host, and this is our weekly YouTube live stream. It's being broadcast live Thursday, February 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. This live stream will also be posted as an episode of the Counting to Five audio podcast. If you're watching live, please feel free to ask questions in the YouTube live chat at any time, and I'll try to monitor that chat during this live stream and answer questions as they come up. And our topic for today is a case called Gill v. Whitford. That's a case about partisan gerrymandering, and the court heard oral arguments on this case back in October, but we're still waiting for an opinion in this case. And the court also has another case, another partisan gerrymandering case called Benisek v. Limon, which it has not heard argument in yet, and I'll talk a little about that in a few moments also. But before I dig into the case, which I'll do in a few moments, I want to first start with a few quick updates about developments at the court over the last week. The first piece of news out of the court involves another application for a death penalty stay. If you were on the live stream last week, you may remember that I said that it's a regular part of the court's work. It's just something that that routinely comes up when there are executions. There are last minute applications to the court to stay the execution, and the court has to rule on those stays. And last week I talked about a couple cases that the court had to deal with that week, and there was one more which happened last Thursday, and it was actually being decided right around the time when last week's live stream was going up. And so this case was a man named John Battaglia, who was convicted of a 2001 murder of his two young daughters. And the application for a stay that was before the court was an argument by his attorneys that he lacked a rational understanding of the reason he was being executed. They argued that he suffered from delusions of persecution, and as a result, he wasn't mentally fit to be executed. And the specific claim was that he should have been provided with funds in order to develop that defense, in order to be able to develop the defense that he wasn't mentally fit to be executed. So that was the application to the court. That application went to Justice Alito because this was out of the Fifth Circuit, and Justice Alito is the justice assigned to deal with emergency applications out of that circuit. Justice Alito referred the application to the full court, which is the normal practice in death penalty cases, assuming there's time to do that. And the court denied the application. And it was, as far as we can tell, unanimous. There were at least no recorded dissents. Nobody went on record dissenting from that decision. So the application was denied. There was no stay. And convicted murderer was executed shortly after the court's order came down on that issue. So that's just another of those. And again, that's a regular part of the court's business is dealing with these death penalty last minute applications as they occur. The court had a few other orders in the last week that all deal with the issue of gerrymandering. So they kind of tie in with the case we're going to be dealing with tonight. Now, the court has already on its docket this term. It has three gerrymandering cases on its docket. There's two of them are partisan gerrymandering cases, arguing that a state has been unconstitutionally gerrymandered by favoring one or the other political party to a extreme degree. There's the Gill v. Whitford case. That's a Wisconsin case that we're going to be talking about in quite a bit of detail in just a few moments. That was argued back in October. And then there's the Benisek v. Limon case. Now that case is a Maryland case, and that case, the Wisconsin case, and most of the partisan gerrymandering cases, and I'll explain this a little more later, most of them involve Republican control the states and accusations that they've gerrymandered the electoral districts to heavily favor the Republicans. Benisek v. Limon, the Maryland case, is the flip side. That's a democratically controlled state, and that's been heavily gerrymandered to increase democratic control over that state. That case is set to be argued on March 28th. Now, Gil v. Whitford, that was argued back in October, so an opinion could come out on that case at any time. But given that they have this other case that's on a closely related issue, the Maryland Benisek v. Limon case, it seems unlikely that they're going to issue the decision in Gil v. Whitford before that second case is even argued, but you never know. So most likely it'll be a little while before we see opinions in either of those two cases. Then the third case that's on the docket is a racial gerrymandering case. That's called Abbott v. Perez out of Texas. That hasn't been officially scheduled yet, but it should fall into the April oral arguments, which is the last set of oral arguments for the term. And that involves Texas's electoral maps and allegations that there's racial gerrymandering. And racial gerrymandering is a much more frequent issue that comes to the court. The court deals with it on a much more regular basis, and there's kind of much more developed case law on racial gerrymandering. But these gerrymandering cases tend to be very fact specific in many cases, and so they come up to the court on a regular basis, and there's often disagreement over how to apply the standards in a particular case. So those are the couple cases that the court already has on its docket, but there have been, there are in the lower courts, there are gerrymandering challenges going on in numerous states across the country. There's somewhere in the order of 10 different states where there are active partisan gerrymandering claims, going on in the courts. And, there have been a number of, several of them have tried to make their way up to the Supreme Court, and I'll talk just briefly about the few that in the past week have there's been some action at the Supreme Court. The first one was on Monday this week, so that's Monday, February 5th. There was a petition concerning the Pennsylvania congressional districts. Now, there was a challenge in Pennsylvania state court to the drawing of the Pennsylvania congressional districts, and the challenge was brought under the Pennsylvania state constitution, so not a federal constitutional claim, but a Pennsylvania state constitutional claim. And the challenge had been brought by the League of Women Voters against it was a 2011 congressional district map. And a few weeks ago, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court held that 2011 congressional district map was an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander under the Pennsylvania state constitution. And as a result of that, they ordered the state to the legislature to draw new maps and draw a new district map and on a very short timetable. Now, this was an interesting case, and it got a lot of attention from people following these election litigation, because normally when there's an issue of state law, and here it's the state constitution, that's an issue where the state Supreme Court is the ultimate decider. It's the final arbiter of questions of state law. And so normally when a state Supreme Court rules that its constitution requires some result, that's the last word, and the United States Supreme Court has nothing to say about that. The United States Supreme Court is the decider on issues of federal law and the U.S. Constitution, but on state law, state Supreme Courts are supreme. So normally this would be basically unreviewable by the Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court made its ruling, and that's an issue of state law, so it ends there. However, a challenge was filed, and the challenge was under the Elections Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and this is the relevant language of that clause. It says, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof." And the argument that was being made, this is an argument by some Republican representatives in Pennsylvania, was that the state courts had the state Supreme Court and the state courts had basically unconstitutionally usurped the role of the legislature. So the U.S. Constitution says that the times, places, and manner of holding elections shall be prescribed by the legislature of the state. And they said, well, the legislature of the state did that, but then the state courts stepped in and overturned the legislature's work. And so basically it's an argument, it's similar in nature, I guess, to something that's known as the political question doctrine in constitutional law. But the idea is that the Constitution has specifically vested the power in one particular political actor, here the legislature, and for a different branch of government to come in and take over from them violates that assignment to the legislature. Now, this was seen as a real long shot theory. There isn't a whole lot behind it. There is a little bit of support there's some support in opinions from the Bush v. Gore case from 2000, but it was widely seen as a long shot theory, and it ended up going nowhere. So this went also there was a stay application that went to Justice Alito, who here again was the circuit justice assigned to that case. And Justice Alito actually just denied the stay without even referring it to the full court, so believing that that it had too little merit or was unlikely to gain support of enough of a majority of the court. So this is interesting. So that was a win for opponents of partisan gerrymandering in that particular case. And there's a kind of a lesson there, which part of the lesson is that the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal courts in particular are not the only check on state behavior or state behavior that many people see as either potentially unconstitutional or not on the up and up. And state courts and state law can also play an important role in that process. And here it was state courts under state law ruling that to be unconstitutional under that state constitution. So that's one of the cases. Another case is Rucho v. Common Cause. And now this was an order from the court that came down on Tuesday, February 6th. Now this case, this is a North Carolina case, and 2 weeks ago on the live stream I discussed an earlier order in this case, but this involved a North Carolina case where there was a challenge to the congressional district map as a extreme partisan gerrymandering, a gerrymander by Republicans. Now, last month, a federal district court ordered the state to immediately draw a new map, and a few weeks ago, this came up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court stayed that order. Basically put that on hold, said that the state did not have to start drawing the new maps. This was just a simple order with no explanation. It is possible that the court was concerned about chaos due to the beginning of the primary filing season, which is about to start in North Carolina, and not wanting to have the introduction of new challenged maps during the election season. We don't really know exactly what their rationale was. But in any case, the court stayed the order to draw a new map right away. So the organization Common Cause, they were the challengers to the old map. They were the challenging the map as an unconstitutional gerrymander. They came to the court. This is what was before the court this week. They asked the court to construe that stay application as a request for Supreme Court review. And so they're basically asking the court to immediately take that case, put it on their calendar to hear that case, and ask for expedited briefing. So the idea was they wanted the court to immediately take the case, put it on their docket, and get it moving so that it could potentially be decided this term. So basically they're looking for a quick answer. The court already has two partisan gerrymandering cases. They want the court to add this third one so they'll get a definitive resolution this year. Presumably they would hope to have something that was usable by the time the 2018 elections roll around. But the court ended up denying that motion on Tuesday this week. So they denied that motion. They didn't take the case right now. There was a dissent by Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg. Again, this is just a brief order. So the dissent just notes that they dissent but doesn't give any explanation or reason for their dissent either. So what does that mean? It means that the lower court order is still stayed. So basically it stays where it is. The order to immediately redraw the North Carolina map is stayed, so that doesn't have to happen. And basically right now it's just waiting for the normal process of working its way up to the Supreme Court for an appeal, but nothing's going to be expedited. The court's not going to hurry up to decide it. This could be a sign that the court intended, even if this is the case comes up to the court in the normal course, the court thinks that it would probably just hold this case until after it's decided the other two partisan gerrymandering cases, Gill and Benisek, those cases, because presumably whatever the court decides in those cases will have a huge effect on other partisan gerrymandering cases that are working their way in the lower courts. So the court would just hold that case and not do anything with it. And if that's what it plans to do anyway, there's no reason to expedite, to hurry up just to hold on to a case for a while. So maybe that's what's going on behind the scenes. But again, we just have to kind of speculate on these just based on these bare orders, because the court doesn't typically on these orders doesn't explain exactly what's going on. So the final order before I get into Gill v. Whitford, the final order of this week I wanted to mention is another one that came down on Tuesday, February 6th. And this is another North Carolina case. This one's called North Carolina v. Covington. And this is a racial gerrymandering case. There was a challenge to various North Carolina state house districts. So this is not the congressional districts that were at issue in the other North Carolina case that I just mentioned. These are state house districts. This case has already been up to the Supreme Court before. And the Supreme Court had affirmed a lower court's finding of that there had been racial gerrymander. And so the issue that's still open is the appropriate remedy. And the district court had ordered the drawing of some new maps. North Carolina had asked the Supreme Court for a stay of that order. And so what happened on Tuesday was the court granted the stay only as to some districts in two counties in the state that were involved in the lower court's order. So the lower court's order for new map drawing goes forward as to the other challenge districts elsewhere in the state, but as to districts in two particular counties, the order is stayed and the North Carolina does not have to redraw those districts. So what is going on here? Those districts, the ones in those two counties, were actually districts that did not have racial gerrymandering allegations. Instead, there was a separate, different challenge was made below, based on state law. There's apparently a North Carolina state law that prohibits mid-decade redistricting. Now, redistricting normally happens every 10 years after a census. So after a census occurs, every state has to draw new districts. North Carolina has a prohibition on doing mid-decade redistricting, and the idea there is just to prevent just constant redrawing of district lines throughout the decade to try and, you know, squeeze out advantage here and there in different between each election. And so instead, it's just every decade redraw the map, and then that map is supposed to hold until the next election. Now, North Carolina has been involved in an enormous amount of litigation over gerrymandering, and various North Carolina maps have gone up and down to the Supreme Court repeatedly over the years. So they don't exactly have stable maps in place in North Carolina. But in any case, they have this state provision prohibiting mid-decade redistricting. So a claim was made under this state law that the districts in those two counties at issue were illegally redistricted under state law. So the court has stepped in and stayed that part of the order. So basically, as it stands now, the districts that were found to be racial gerrymanders, those will be redistricted, but the state law claims are stayed for now. So that'll just await a potential, you know, future appeal up to the Supreme Court. The court's not going to step in advance, and, or the court is not going to allow them to be, or not going to allow the lower court to force those to be redrawn, at this point in time. There were some, disagreements on the recorder on that. Justices Alito and Thomas, would have stayed all of the order as to all of the challenge districts. So including the, racially gerrymandered districts. So they apparently, felt that there was, some reason either, problem with the districts as they were drawn or concerns over the timing or something that led them to think they should be stayed. One thing that's been noted on that, it was only Justices Alito and Thomas. There's been a lot of attention and talk to, Justice Gorsuch being part of a new kind of, three justice, conservative wing of the court, made up of Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch. But at least in this particular case, he was not noted as, joining Alito and Thomas. So that's an interesting, difference between those justices. And it'll be interesting to see if, in future, gerrymandering cases, if there's a difference that shows up in those later cases. On the other side, Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg would have denied the stay, across the board. So they would have let the redistricting go ahead for those districts in those two counties that involved the state law claims also. So that's it for the new orders on the court dealt with this week about those gerrymandering cases. So with that out of the way, I'm going to move on and dive into the main, case of tonight's live stream. And, if there are any questions, please just at any time leave them in the live chat, which I'll keep an eye on, and I can try and address those. So Gil v. Whitford, this is a case out of Wisconsin, as I mentioned before, about partisan gerrymandering. So first, just real quick, I want to kind of go back to basics. What is gerrymandering? So basically gerrymandering is redrawing electoral districts in order to advantage either a particular politician or a particular political faction. The term gerrymandering was coined all the way back in 1812, and it was named after a redistricting plan that was signed by the governor of Massachusetts. It was Elbridge Gerry, and so his name became attached to this process, and it was called a gerrymander, and eventually became pronounced gerrymander. And the name dates to 1812, but the practice has existed basically since the beginning of the United States. The very first congressional election in 1789, there were allegations of basically this type of process, even though the name didn't exist yet. And it's always been very controversial. It's always been there've been accusations, and it's been kind of looked at as a kind of a politically nefarious process of redrawing districts just to gain advantage. I want to kind of lay out a little more background on redistricting, because that'll help to understand where gerrymandering comes into it and what some of the issues involved are. So a couple important points about redistricting. The first is, and I mentioned this earlier in discussing the North Carolina case, but states are required to periodically redistrict. So there is no option to just leave things as they are, leave things alone. Every 10 years, there's a census. Populations always shift. They'll shift, you know, between different districts in the state. And when you're dealing with the United States House of Representatives, so the congressional districts, population shifts from state to state. So a given state may gain or lose districts from one census to the next due to these population changes. And that means even more drastic changes. So when the populations shift either within a state or from state to state, there's a requirement that districts be redrawn, because using unequal districts is under Supreme Court precedence is a constitutional violation. There's a series of Supreme Court cases that establish something that's usually referred to as the one person, one vote principle, and it requires electoral districts be basically equal in population, roughly equal in population. So redistricting has to occur every 10 years. Now, number two, this is where things get complicated. There is no single accepted method for drawing district lines. There are a variety of different goals that have been approved by courts as legitimate goals that legislators can seek to meet in drawing these districts. And these various legitimate goals or factors that are used, they have obvious political implications for a particular map. And let me get a little more concrete. This is just kind of a partial list of some of the common factors that legislators use in order to as kind of goals for drawing new districts. Now, one is that new districts should track the existing districts to the extent possible. And there's a few reasons you might want to do this. And one is it allows for the development of stable, long-term relationships between representatives and the people and businesses in the districts that they represent. And also just the practical point that the existing map that's already in place is an obvious starting point in the, you know, negotiations or process of drawing a new map. You start with what you have and then you adjust it as you need to deal with population changes and the like. So that's one factor that's often used. How close does the new map stay to the previous map? Another very common criteria that's used is that districts should be, to the extent possible, contiguous and compact. So rather than having sprawling districts that stretch across a wide expanse of the state, you have tightly close districts that cover a relatively compact region. There's a few reasons you might want to do this. It allows for easier travel through the district. There are some districts, especially in some of the western states, some of the large western states, where there are districts that actually extend for hundreds of miles, which can make it, you know, just difficult for a representative in that district to be to know the district and visit and meet with different people in that district. These, you know, compact districts make it easier for representatives to know the constituents. And one other reason is it prevents some of the most obvious and egregious gerrymanders, where you have district lines that snake in and out of communities, carving them up, even carving up single neighborhoods into different separate districts for some political advantage. If you have a compactness requirement, then that kind of eliminates some of those techniques that are particularly, you know, seen as particularly egregious. Another common factor is that electoral districts should follow local political boundaries like county lines or town lines to the extent possible. And there's a few reasons you might want to do this. It can allow for better coordination between local and state or national representatives if you have, if you aren't just carving up individual neighborhoods to create a legislative district, but instead the legislative district just covers certain, already existing, political communities. And those, all of those factors, tracking existing districts, the compactness, or following political boundaries, those factors make it easier for constituents to figure out and keep track of who represents them. They make things simpler and easier. But there are other factors that also come into play that may run counter to some of those that I've already mentioned. One is that districts should follow common economic interests. So some examples here is if you might say if you had in a state certain areas that are that depend on a tourist economy, but they're not necessarily all grouped in one compact place, or areas that have an agricultural regions that depend on agriculture for employment, or potentially if on a coastal state, a coastal area that depends on fishing, as a major industry. It might make sense to group some of those common interests into a single district, even if that district will not be as compact and tight as it might have been otherwise. And that would allow the representatives to better understand and more coherently pursue the constituents' goals, because there's kind of common interests among the people collected in the district. Another criteria that's actually a very common criteria, is that districts should not be drawn in such a way as to exclude a incumbent representative's home from the district. And this one seems kind of an odd one because it's focusing on the particular representative that's in that district and has in some cases caused districts to be drawn with strange shapes or carve outs just to include the home of a representative who happens to be representing that district. But there are some reasons for that. There are often in states there are residency requirements in many states that require a representative to live in the district they represent. And so if lines are drawn without any regard to where the representatives live, then you can district a representative right out of their district, forcing them to either move in order to remain representing that district, or forcing them to compete in a completely different district that they haven't been representing already because their home has been shifted to a different location. And part of the rationale for this is that if constituents in a particular district have a chosen representative, someone that they elected and has been representing them, then having a rule like this in place, it protects their ability to continue to reelect their chosen representative. And it prevents a particularly ugly tactic for unseating political rivals by drawing them out of their districts or deliberately districting multiple incumbents from another party into a single district so that they all have to compete against each other, things like that. But so those are just some examples of some of the like commonly cited goals for what should be achieved in drawing a district. Now, here's the thing. Every one of those goals can be used in some circumstance for either personal or partisan advantage by elected representatives. Any one of those in a given circumstance might create an advantage, and they're not all going to cut in the same direction. So and the more legitimate factors that are in play, the more flexibility there is in drawing a map. So if a legislator can look at a particular map and say, well, in this particular area, this particular region of the state, if we were to follow the county line, then that would put this set of voters in my district and cut these other voters out of my district, and consider whether that would be good or bad. Or instead of following the county line, if we cut straight down the middle and create a more compact, tighter district, well, does that benefit this candidate or that candidate or this party or that party? The more factors you have in play, the more opportunity there is to pick and choose which to favor in a given area or region in order to get some sort of partisan advantage. So that's kind of a background. There are a lot of different goals that are all seen as legitimate and reasonable goals, but the more goals you have, the more room for manipulation. And then the third kind of background point is that partisan politics has always played a role in redistricting. Sometimes it's, and this the concern that's been very much involved in these cases that are at the Supreme Court right now, and has been a big concern recently, is states where there's one dominant party, where one party controls both the legislature and both houses of the legislature and the governorship of the state, and that dominant party can gerrymander basically to cement their political advantage. But sometimes, and this is more common in a state where there is some sort of divided government, either different houses of the legislature or the governor is a different party from the legislature, where instead you see a bipartisan collaboration on gerrymandering, where the two parties, the major parties, will get together and carve up the districts so that there are safe districts for powerful incumbents on both sides. So you may have a state where, you know, say it's roughly evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, and maybe carved up in such a way that, you know, 40% of the seats are very safe Republican districts. Another 40% of the seats are very safe Democratic districts. And then there may be, you know, the other 20% of the seats in the middle that are more contested, more closer, closer seats or something, like that. And in that case, you know, it can be both seen as serving, those politicians' individual interests by giving them a safe district that allows them to, not have to worry about, future, re-election, election fights against the other party. But also the argument on the other side is it creates a level of stability, where you have, you know, institutional continuity in both the majority and minority party over time. But the other part of it is that this, the whole process, of drawing new districts is, and this was anticipated in the U.S. Constitution, but it's generally done by the legislature. And the politicians who are drawing these maps often have detailed knowledge about the political makeup of their districts, from many sources. Some of it may be garnered from meetings and communications with their constituents, from their fundraising attempts, from the countless hours spent organizing door-to-door campaigns and other election strategy. And in some cases, they may be just intuitively aware of the likely electoral implications of changes in district lines. So some level of partisan knowledge, of the impacts of adopting various different district lines, it has always been there and always will be there as long as politicians have any role in the process. It's hard to imagine party-affiliated politicians who are setting the stage for future partisan elections and elections that will not only determine their own future in office, but the fate of their legislative agendas, depending on how many seats their party can control, and then expecting those people to be entirely indifferent to the political makeup of the districts that they draw. It's not a realistic picture. So that's why focuses on partisan gerrymandering tends not to be about eliminating partisan gerrymandering, but more about trying to define how much is too much. Is there a way to curtail this somehow to rein it in without somehow drawing a bright line and saying, politicians can never take partisan considerations, never have those in mind, because that seems, unrealistic. So, you know, I've said that gerrymandering is an ancient practice. It's ubiquitous, at least to some degree. It's inevitable. So what's the problem, and what's the real problem? Why has this become such a huge issue? Well, there's old reasons and there's new reasons. First, the old reasons. Gerrymandering is ugly business. You know, general public, when they learn about gerrymandering or see these, you know, especially these, crazy misshapen districts, tend to find it extremely distasteful. It's politicians redrawing districts for their own selfish interests. It seems like a perversion of democracy. It's even worse when there's a lack of transparency and this is done behind closed doors, as has been the case in some recent, cases. And there's a cliche that you hear a lot if you follow the gerrymandering litigation and the news about it, and you hear it over and over again, and it usually goes something like this: in a democracy, the voters are supposed to choose their representatives, not the other way around. And, you know, it's a cliche, but it captures very well kind of the public feeling about gerrymandering. This is ugly. This is not something people like to see. It seems kind of underhanded. But there are also new issues, new problems that have made this increasingly a kind of a hot button political issue. And the big one is advances in technology. So there's redistricting software that's used by state legislators in order to draw these new district maps. And this software, along with rich and detailed demographic data, makes gerrymandering possible on a level of sophistication that was previously impossible. And the software that's used often allows people to, the legislators, to enter various criteria about how the districts should be drawn, so they can enter desired tolerances for things like compactness and following political boundaries, and then automatically generate maps that are optimized in particular ways. And so the concern here is that gerrymandering used to be somewhat self-limiting. So when a particular party was in power and they chose to draw a map, they had a choice. They could either draw the map to concentrate, you know, larger numbers of their party's voters in certain districts to make safe districts, or they could spread their party's votes over more districts to capture a larger percentage of the legislature, but with thinner margins in each district. So if you spread your voters to get, you could either, you know, just to use a simple example, you could have, you know, 60 plus percent margins, or, you know, in a number of safe districts, or by trimming those margins down to 50 something percent, you could cover even more districts and get yourself a bigger chunk of the legislature. But the broader you spread your voters, the more districts you try to capture, and the thinner the margin that between your party's voters and the other party's voters in these various districts, the greater risk of suffering a huge loss if there's a wave election that goes toward the other party. So if you're one party, say the Republicans, and you want to capture a huge chunk of the state legislature, and you spread your voters over numerous districts, so you have 51 or 52% of the voters in, you know, 75% of the legislature, well, that's great if everything goes right according to those percentages and you win three quarters of the legislature. But if for one reason or another there's a wave election, there's maybe a, you know, hugely popular national candidate or a big ballot initiative or something like that that drives turnout away from the Republicans and toward the Democrats, you could all of a sudden have a huge upset that throws huge numbers of districts to the other party. And this is a real phenomenon that has happened in the past, where one party has had a dominant position, but based on very thin margins in a lot of districts, and then a big election has turned a huge number of those districts the other way. But now with this software, the sophisticated software, not only can they draw the maps, but they can run simulations and do sensitivity testing on this map. So basically what they're doing is running simulations where they're doing random election results based on different shifts in voter behavior, and trying to draw districts in such a way that under reasonable predictions or assumptions of future voter behavior, even if there's, you know, relatively large swings to the other party, they'll still maintain control in these districts. And the argument is that can now be done in a very reliable way, so that it's now possible to not only capture a large number of districts, but to do it with margins that are safe enough that they're unlikely to suffer big losses from these wave elections. So it's made it a much more serious problem, and that leads to what's referred to as entrenchment. And the argument here is there's a huge amount of power in being the party in control just after a census redistricting. So a 10-year census occurs, a redistricting is done. If the party in power can draw a map that will reliably cause it to retain control for the next decades, so through the next five elections every 2 years, then they will still be in power and in place to design the next map for the following 10 years. Again, using, you know, all these techniques and sensitivity testing and everything to make sure that they can maintain their control for another period of time. And so the in theory, the idea is that if using these powerful tools, a party can essentially semi-permanently entrench itself in power in a particular state. And there have been a number of examples in recent years of one party, and this has usually been the Democrats in recent years, one party winning a majority and even a somewhat strong majority of votes statewide, but still holding only a minority of legislative seats because of the way that the districts have been drawn, so that the Democratic votes, even though they're getting lots of votes, they're concentrated in a small number of districts, and they are unable to gain a legislative majority, even though they have a majority of the voters in the state. And then another thing is, I mentioned those various traditional districting criteria, like compactness and following the existing political boundaries. The problem now is that the focus on those traditional criteria is no longer effective in policing gerrymandering. People may be familiar with the kind of crazy inkblot-like districts that have, you know, tendrils snaking out in all directions in order to capture specific populations and pull them into one district. Wisconsin's map, the map that's being challenged here as an extreme Republican gerrymander, is not like that. Wisconsin's map has relatively compact districts. If you look at the map, just visually eye the map, it doesn't look particularly crazy or out of order. The map respects local political boundaries, so it's relatively compact. It respects political boundaries, and still, despite that, it heavily favors Republicans, and that's not really in dispute. That despite those things, it heavily favors Republican politicians and gives them a large advantage in the elections. So that kind of lays out what the problem is. So now the question is, what can the courts do? So first, what have they done so far? So let's look at the Supreme Court. The last time the Supreme Court has dealt with a partisan gerrymandering case was more than a decade ago. It was a case called Veith v. Jubilier in 2004. And that case resulted in a fractured decision. By fractured decision, I mean where there wasn't a clear majority. So there was a plurality, that's a less than majority opinion, on the winning side. There was a plurality of four justices, and these are four of the more conservative justices on the court at the time. It was Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices O'Connor, Scalia, and Thomas. And they held, or they wrote in their opinion, that political gerrymandering is just not something that courts can manage. There was no manageable standard. It was not something that they're in a position to rule on, and so there shouldn't be a viable claim. Now, the four more liberal members of the court at the time, so that was Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, they dissented, and they would have found in that particular case that there was an unconstitutional gerrymander. But the ninth justice, and that was Justice Kennedy, who's often referred to as the swing vote on the court, he held in his own separate concurring opinion, he agreed with the four conservatives in finding no workable standard in that particular case. There was just no workable standard in order to determine whether there had been an impermissible partisan gerrymandering. But he held out the possibility that in the future, in some future case, there might be a manageable standard might be developed and presented to the courts so that they could rule on this type of cases. So that brings us to this case right here, Gil v. Wifford. So what has happened is social scientists have come forward and basically said, we can provide the manageable objective tests that Justice Kennedy said he was looking for. And there's a few different tests that have been involved, that have come up. The one that's gotten the most attention is something called the efficiency gap. And the efficiency gap is something that measures, what it's based on is measuring the wasted votes in a particular election. And it defines a wasted vote as either any vote for a candidate who loses. So if you vote for the losing candidate, your vote was wasted. It had no effect. And any votes for the winning candidate in excess of the number that was needed to win. Those would also be wasted votes. And the idea is that you can, with this method, you count up how many votes were wasted for each of the parties, and that gives you a measure of how fair how gerrymandered or how fair the map is. And so just to give a very simple stripped down example of how this could work in practice is just, let's just imagine very simply, imagine a state with 100 total, voters, 50 of whom are Republicans and 50 are Democrats, and they're divided into four districts of 25, people apiece. Right? Now, first imagine that they were just evenly divided between these four districts. And so you end up having two districts that the Democrats take 13 to 12 and two districts that the Republicans take 13 to 12. Well, in those cases, in each of the districts that was won by the Democrats, you had 12 wasted Republican votes for a total of 24 wasted Republican votes. And the Democrats wasted no votes because they had only as many as they needed to win. In the other two votes, it was the other way around. You had, the Republicans had 13 and had just as many as they needed to win those districts, but the Democrats wasted 12 in each district. So you'd have 24 wasted votes on each side. So that would be neutral under this efficiency gap test. It would be, there'd be no gap. There'd be zero gap between the Republican and Democrat wasted votes. And so that would be a neutral district. But you could also carve those up differently and place those 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats in the districts in different proportions. So on the other hand, imagine you had three districts that were Republican dominated, 15 Republicans to 10 Democrats. And then you had one district that was dominated by Democrats 20 to 5. So that the numbers add up the same. You still have 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, but here the Republicans take three districts and the Democrats only take one district. If you do the math on the wasted votes, the Democrats, where before each party wasted 24 votes, now the Democrats have wasted 10 votes in each of the districts they lost for a total of 30. And then they've wasted another, 7 votes in the district they won because they only needed 13 to win it and they used 20. So you've got 37 votes where you had 24 or 37 wasted votes for the Democrats where before you had 24. On the Republican side, they've wasted 2 votes in each of the, districts that they won 15 to 10 because they only needed 13 to get a majority. So they've wasted 2 votes in each of those and wasted 5 votes in the district that they lost 20 to 5. So there they've only wasted 11 votes. Instead of the 24 they had wasted before. So now you have this large differential between the 37 votes that the Democrats wasted versus the 11 votes the Republicans wasted. So it's a huge differential. So this would be a very, very heavily, gerrymandered, district toward the Republicans. So that's just kind of just a very, very simple little example of how this test works. There's another set of tests that are known as symmetry tests, and they basically look at, you know, depending on what percentage of the vote a particular party wins in the state, what percentage of the seats in the legislature do they get for a particular percentage of the vote. And the idea is, suppose in just the way that voters tend to clump and just statistically how votes are distributed. If Republicans were to win 55% of the vote, they're not necessarily going to win 55% of the seats. There's usually some additional bonus that a winning party wins gets on top of their percentage. So suppose you had a state where if Republicans were to win with 55% of the vote, they would tend to take about 65% of the seats. Well, then if the same thing held true in the opposite direction, in the case where if Democrats won 55% of the vote, they would also get 65% of the seats, then that would be a symmetrical, and that would be fair under these symmetry tests. But if it was the case that when Republicans win 55% of the votes, they get 65% of the seats, but if Democrats turn around and win 55% of the vote, they're winning only 50% of the seats or even less than 50% of the seats, then that would be very asymmetrical, and that would violate these kind of symmetry tests. So these are some tests, and they, you know, they're presented as kind of objective social scientific methods of determining how gerrymandered a particular state is. But these tests aren't without their criticisms. There's a number of criticisms then raised to these. One is the argument that, you know, in the United States, elections are district by district. It's a particular candidate versus a particular candidate, even if they're associated with a given party, and that these tests require you to aggregate individual races across a state. So to treat any vote for any Republican as kind of fungible and interchangeable with a vote for any other Republican. And it ignores the role of particularly charismatic candidates in some districts or particularly unlikely or unlikable voters in other districts that may drive voters to stay home, and things like that, which affect the individual turnout and results in particular races. And here you're just adding those up across the whole state and treating them as if they're all the same. On the other end, the proponents of these kind of tests say, well, this kind of aggregate treatment is good enough for the people drawing the districts in the first place. They do that all the time and assume a Republican voter is a Republican voter, a Democratic voter is a Democratic voter. So it should be good enough for this test too. Another argument just says that these aren't sufficiently tested in the real world. The efficiency gap, for example, has only been around for a few years. This measurement didn't even exist until a few years ago. And so they argue you shouldn't be cementing something like this into constitutional law when it really hasn't been thoroughly tested. And in related to that, there are arguments that these measures are unstable across multiple elections. When you run these historically and test the efficiency gap on a particular district across a few election cycles, the level of gerrymandering that it measures can swing quite a bit between elections, even though it's the exact same districts and they haven't been changed. And there's also complaints that the models require some debatable assumptions. For example, there are uncontested elections in states where only one party puts up a candidate for a particular seat, and assumptions have to be made about how do you treat that, how do you deal with that in this model. And then one other argument is there's a complaint by the Republicans that there is a natural bias that causes a map that was actually drawn completely neutrally, a map that's drawn without taking any political affiliation into consideration, just because of the political geography, those maps tend to have a bias toward Republicans. And let me give an example. When I gave that simple example before where you had three districts where the Republicans were ahead 15 to 10 and one district where the Democrats were ahead 20 to 5, right? That actually, as in a very, very crude and simplified way, that illustrates what you see in many states in the urban-rural divide, where you have urban districts that are heavily, heavily dominated by Democrats, often by a very large margin, and rural or suburban areas where Republicans dominate, but by only smaller margins. And that creates some degree of efficiency gap, but it's not anything that's being created by map makers. It's something that exists in the natural, just the distribution of where people choose to live. So the argument here is that a neutral a neutrally drawn map is actually will show up under these tests as being gerrymandered toward the Republicans. So essentially what these tests do is put a thumb on the scale and give the Democrats greater rein to kind of gerrymander to correct the Republican bias, but puts the Republicans in a position where they're unable to, where they have little breathing room because of this bias. Now, the extent of that bias is heavily disputed, but that's the basic argument. No one argues that there isn't some bias just based on that, just the population distribution of Democrats and Republicans. And then another argument is that these tests require some sort of arbitrary cutoff. You have to decide how much is too much still, even with these tests, and setting some number, some percentage of efficiency gap that's too far, is not the sort of, that kind of line drawing is not the sort of thing that courts are really, made to do, and don't have a strong, independent kind of judicial reason for choosing one particular line over another. So those are some of the, you know, arguments against. And, you know, so this is the big question of what the court will end up doing here. Will a majority of the court find one of these tests, to be sufficient to put into place, or will they decide? So this is another criticism that critics of these tests have made is that there's kind of a bait and switch going on. That these social science tests kind of give the promise of objectivity. We have this scientific test. You plug in the numbers, plug in the number of votes won or lost in various different elections into a formula that gives you a number, and that number tells you if it's too gerrymandered. However, when challenged, and this is something that you can, if you listen to the oral argument in this case, you can see this come up a few times, when challenged on specific aspects, some of these specific critiques of a given test, there's often a fallback to say, you know, this test isn't the be-all and end-all. It's one of several factors that all kind of point in this direction. If you look at, you know, this, the symmetry tests or the efficiency gap tests, of, you know, along with these other, the evidence of gerrymandering, take these things together, then that as a whole demonstrates that this is unconstitutional gerrymandering. So there's a kind of an argument that there's a bait and switch that is presented as a simple objective standard, but in fact it's falling back to a kind of multi-factor, totality of the circumstances type test. But again, you know, the big thing standing behind all this is the ugliness of the whole the process. And what's apparent is no one, even though, you know, people, there's, you know, there's arguments and some, you know, arguably some strong arguments that this is not something that courts can effectively police. No one actually wants to defend this practice as a good thing. No one wants to, there's defenses of this as something that legislatures are allowed to do and courts have no role in stopping it, but no one really makes the argument that this kind of extreme partisan gerrymandering is good for a functional democracy. And so that's kind of hanging in the background. There's a strong desire to kind of rein this kind of thing in, but a big question about if the court does want to get into the middle of this, how will they do it? And one concern that has to be at least in the background, and Chief Justice Roberts also actually voiced this concern at the oral arguments, is that in these election cases, unlike the vast majority of the cases that the Supreme Court hears, they're a part of the court's what's known as its mandatory appellate docket. And these are cases that the court doesn't have a choice in taking or not. Essentially, any election, any redistricting case that gets appealed up to the Supreme Court has to take and hear it. And having a test that is not, that is, you know, some sort of multi-factor, you know, totality of the circumstances type of test puts the Supreme Court in the position in numerous elections in states all across the country for congressional districts and state districts of essentially being in the position of having to choose the winner and loser in all these, you know, these different, kind of election contests, you know, choosing a political party that's the winner and loser in all these contests. And that puts them in kind of an ugly political position. Which especially if they have no, clear, bright line standard that they can rely on, and they have to resort to multiple different factors. So I think that brings me to the end of what I had on this case. It'll be interesting to see how the court sorts through these type of cases. I think in the future I may try and do a live stream episode on the other partisan gerrymandering case, the Benisek v. Lamone out of Maryland, because that raises some interesting different issues than this Wisconsin case. So we'll see, but I may address that one in a future episode. But for now, that brings us to the end of this live stream. The next weekly live stream will be a week from today, Thursday, February 15th at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And that's our usual weekly time, Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern. But you can also always check the Counting to Five YouTube channel to find the next scheduled live stream. Right now, the court is still in recess between its January and February oral arguments, but it returns for February oral arguments on Tuesday, February 20th. So next week, that's the 15th again, next week in a live stream, I plan to preview the cases that the court will hear in the first week of February arguments. So that's the plan for next week. Whether you're watching this on YouTube or listening to the audio podcast, I would love your feedback. You can leave comments on the show notes at countingto5.com or on the Counting to Five YouTube channel or Facebook page or tweet at Counting to Five or send an email to me at mike@countingto5.com. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel or audio podcast to make sure you don't miss future episodes, and thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.